Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. Today, my guest is Aaron Sadoff, the superintendent of the North Fond du Lac School District in Wisconsin. Aaron is somebody who I've always been enthusiastically attracted to because of his enthusiasm for life. Aaron today is going to talk to us about why he feels that being optimistic and pursuing a culture of optimism can change the way in which students learn, teachers teach, and communities grow. Here we go. Here's my interview with Aaron Sadoff.
Everyone is waiting on. Well, there's a song horizon, just you wait.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky, and today I'm here with Aaron Sadoff, who is the superintendent of the North Fond du Lac School District. I first met Aaron about 8 years ago, when he and I had first become superintendents, and I was attracted to Aaron for two reasons. His blind optimism that he carries with him that really propels him, as well as his strong sense of humor and his child advocacy. Aaron has been the superintendent of the North Fond du Lac School District for nine years. Yes. And he is now leading that school district, but he is also working nationally to help other school systems and staffs find their optimism. So welcome to the podcast, Aaron.
Thanks, Ted. It's an honor. It's my first ever on podcast. I've listened to tons of them. You're almost like Mike Rowe to me. So, hey, this is going to be cool.
Yeah, I wish I was Mike Rowe. That would be awesome. So, Aaron, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up, go to high school? What was family life like?
December 17th, 1971. I was born to Richard and Mary Sadoff in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Really good story at the beginning is I didn't have a name for the first 2 days of my life. My mom's a Wimberger, my grandfather's German, and he couldn't say Sebastian, and that's what they're going to name me. And that's like pre-Little Mermaid, you know, when Sebastian wasn't cool. That was like some kid in the corner that had no friends probably. So he couldn't say it. My dad says, we're not going to name this kid after something your father can't pronounce. So they got a baby book and they went through and the first name, A-A-R, Aaron, there it is. So then I got named Aaron.
No need to go further.
Amen. So I grew up in a family. My mom and dad, great people. My dad is he's an interesting guy. He passed away 15 years ago. His father, Dave Sadoff, married Mary Foy. So Dave Sadoff was a Russian Jew, Mary Foy an Irish Catholic, and what they produced was my father, Dick, and he was just an amazing guy. I learned a ton of stuff from him. And then my mom grew up in Eden, Wisconsin on a farm, and one of seven kids, and I always remember my grandma was a head cook at St. Mary's in Eden, grade school, and so we always had the Clean Plate Club and learned a lot from there. So I grew up in a very loving, diverse type of mindset of different things. And I was a middle child. I have an older sister and a younger brother who I would consider my best friends and right up there with anybody that I'd like to hang out with, talk with now. And I continued to go on, went to Lakeshore Elementary, then Sabish Junior High and Goodrich High School in Fond du Lac, and learned a lot of stuff. That was pretty normal. You know, went through stuff. My dad was an entrepreneur, and he taught me something. He loved old cars. He street rodded cars. As a matter of fact, when I was in high school, he and I did a 1937 Chevy pickup truck. He must have redone, 40, 50 cars, plus big into antiques and old Coke coolers. And he did a lot of stuff. He always says, if you could take it from your brain and put it to your fingers, you're always going to make money. Well, he loved old cars, but he knew he could make a living doing it. So what he ended up doing is he found this manufacturer who made compact furniture, like those bag chairs, yeah, and soft-sided coolers. And since he couldn't be making money with making cars, he figured, well, I can go to all these car shows, sell this stuff, I'm around it, I'll have a lot of fun. So I kind of grew up as a carny going and selling with him all over the country, compact furniture and soft-sided coolers. So I learned a lot of stuff that way. So I graduated high school, but it was between my senior year and the Christmas break. One of my friends, Scott Fairchild from Illinois, his dad was one of my dad's best friends. He had gone to the military. Now, this is Cold War's over. We're not going to war. He went into the military, to the Army. He was an infantryman, went out to Seattle or Fort Lewis, got a motorcycle. I think it was a Hurricane. They paid for college. I'm like, I am sick of school. I actually did nursery school, preschool twice. I was supposed to be advanced, but sharing in colors, I wasn't all that good at. So I did that twice. So I was in school for like 14 years. I'm like, hey, I want to move on. I don't want to go to school right now. I want to do something of my own. My parents supported me and they would have helped with college, but I said, I'm going to go in the Army. I went and signed up, didn't even tell them until I came back, and it was delayed entry. So then I went in later on after the summer. So,
and this was, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this was, what year did you graduate from high school?
1990. So 1990. This was 89. So 89, I signed up and they showed me three things I could be, because in my mind, it was going to be the lowest amount of time. So I got 2 years in training time. So I had three options. It was a preacher's assistant, a cook, or a cavalry scout. A reconnaissance. I'm like, so they show these videos of people coming out of helicopters, driving. I said, I'm a cavalry scout. I'm going to go recon. So I did that. Needless to say, I never rode on a motorcycle nor shimmied down from a helicopter, but it got me into it. So I signed up for that because I figured if I liked it, great. If not, hey, I can get out. And I'd have college money and I'd be in the United States because they're not going to ship me overseas, you know. So graduate, and then I got into the military on, I think it was August 2nd, 1st or 2nd, 1990, and that's the day Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Everything changed. So I went to Fort Knox. There it was, one station unit training. So I did basic training and AIT for 17 weeks. They said,
what is AIT?
AIT is where your advanced individual training, okay. Where I learned how to be a cavalry scout. So okay. I was a 19 series. 11 series is infantry. So you go to a different AIT. If you're going to be a mechanic, if you're going to be a linguist, whatever. Those, everybody does basic training. And then you go to your individual learning. It's still the same setup now. So I went there, got through, got done the day before Thanksgiving in 1990. We were the last group to be able to go home. So went home and got orders to go to Ansbach, Germany to fill in for 1-1 Cav there. At that time, everybody was deploying over to Desert Storm or Desert Shield at the time. And what happened was, as we were graduating, we were just a few of many throughout the United States that as they're amping up the war, hey, you guys are going to go fill in for these troops over there. They were already deployed. So I came home for a couple weeks, got on a plane, went to Germany. I was in Germany for like, I guess, 6-7 days, got on a plane, went to Saudi Arabia. And from there I spent, we went until April 30th that I was in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Kuwait. Spent most of my time on Highway 1 just north of Kuwait, kind of west of Basra. And really was just MP stuff after the war. It went really fast. One thing that I can, that this resonates with me. So our job was to do recon and go out. We weren't the Navy SEALs or we weren't like the advanced special forces, but we were in front of people and we checked things out and then we'd call other people in. Our number one piece of equipment we would use would be a radio. We learned how to do that because we'd find things and then call an artillery or we'd call an infantry or armor, whatever. And one of the things that our job evolved to is clearing foxholes and finding all these Iraqis. And what I've learned is there really isn't Iraqi. It's whatever tribe you're part of, Sunni or Shia, and then within there they're broken down. And one of my biggest takeaways from the military is that people aren't defined by some political nationalism. I mean, you can over time. I think America is an example of it working because we all think of ourselves as Americans. But if you went back to the 1800s, early 1800s, probably being an American wasn't that big of a deal. But if you were a Massachusetts, or for you, or did I say that right? Massachusetts?
It's close enough.
All right. So that's one thing I learned is that people are people. And we saw all these people in foxholes are out in the middle of the desert with like a bag of figs, brand new shoes, and a some sort of weapon with very little ammunition. And our biggest thing was we had a lot of people giving up. They wanted help. They saw us as helping, not as the enemy. So that's kind of what my role was after the 100-hour war was to do that, was to take in with my group and take in the people, prisoners, and help them out and then get them in the right area. So it was more of a peacekeeping type of thing, and I learned a ton. Got back, was in Germany then they were starting to downsize because Cold War is over. So they were downsizing and moving a lot of divisions around. So I was in Germany for another six months till about August. So I never got home. I went on leave after basic training. War's over. Everybody's going home to see their families and stuff. And I didn't get to see my family or anything until like about 6 months after the war, just because I had used up all my leave time. And then I came back, went to Fort Carson in Colorado, spent about a year and a half there. And then I got out of the military and was better for it. It was probably the best thing I ever did. If people would ask me, would you do it all over again tomorrow? And I would say, I don't know, but if they would say, we'll give you $1 million to take those experiences away, I'd say, no way in hell, I'm going to keep those. I just started to talk to some more friends that I knew back in the day. What I learned is I trust two types of people inherently without knowing them. Number one, people who have been to the military and made it out successfully. And number two, wrestlers, because wrestlers are just driven and they know they can get stuff done. And also those types of people. So, no, it was awesome. I learned so much about people. I learned about, I grew up in a white area. I mean, Wisconsin, in my high school, Goodrich High School in Fond du Lac, we had probably 1,500 kids. You know, you could count on one hand the different minorities that we had back in, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I'll never forget one of the things that really stuck out in basic training. I was a squad leader in charge of cleaning a bathroom. I had three African-American guys that were on there on my squad, and I had, I think it was four white guys. And so I was in charge of making the schedule for cleaning the bathroom. Well, I made the schedule for cleaning the bathroom, and here come, you know, all three of the African-American guys telling me how much of a racist and how I hate the black man and everything. And then here I come just after that happens. Here comes the four white guys saying, you know what? You just love them, don't you? Did you look at your skin? You know what color you are? So I had both sides saying that, you know, that I was discriminating. And I learned something there that it's all about perception. It's all about opening up. So I don't think this was the right solution, but it worked for me. I figured, screw that. I'm just going to start cleaning. So within a day or two, everybody started to help. So it was one of those things, instead of going and saying, no, I'm this and all this, you know, like right now in schools, we do a lot with talking. It really works and helping with kids understand about compassion and understanding and empathy. Back then, it was all about, you know what, I'm just going to do it. I'll just example, they'll know I'm just like them. They want to help out, cool. If not, hey, then we'll all get in trouble because I won't get done on time. So it is what it is.
You figured that out at 18.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, but one thing as we go through and what I've learned, I'm 46 now. And I taught psychology, and that's another thing. When I was in high school, I never took psychology. I thought it was the dumbest thing ever. Like, you're going to tell me that there's a reason I act the way I do? And I couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, psychology is probably one of the most important disciplines and sciences we have right now. But what I've learned is with memory is not a recording. You know, it's not like our memories is a video recorder that keeps it all coming in.
It's an emotion.
Yeah, our memory is an edited movie. And the thing about edited movies, like when you asked me about the military, how old were you at that time? 18. What I did and how I did it wasn't purposeful for a bigger idea. But now when I look back and I edit that film and I can see, oh, that's why it happened like that. That was my purpose. And then I can replicate that, or I could see some of those characteristics go through. So one thing that I've learned is, you know, nobody has to be set on what their history was. You can always edit that. And the slant you put on it, the things you choose to remember, like I talked about my dad wasn't the same. There's a lot of difficult times that we had and, you know, things we disagreed on. But there was more a lot great. So my vision and my remembrance of my dad, I choose to edit it so it's something that really helps me, because other stuff really doesn't matter so much anymore. So I might have been 18, but what I've learned is now, looking back, I understand the purpose of it so I can replicate it.
Right. That's a pretty cool way to look back at your own memories, and it's a good mindset.
Yeah, and over and over, Sean Aker's done a lot of great work, and we'll talk about that in a little bit about the happiness advantage. But, you know, like at night, if you pray with the group and at your table, or you reflect on what you did really good, people who journal, you know, they call that the doubler, where you reflect on what you did and you remember those good times, and it's actually reliving them. So your brain gets those endorphins and it starts to go, and it puts you in that positive emotional state, which helps. Think about when you get together with your friends from high school. You tell all these stories. And, you know, like maybe 6% of it's accurate. You know, the other ones aren't too far off. But you remember the good stuff. You know, and that's okay.
There's not a night in my life that doesn't go by where my children or my wife accuse me of what you just stated. And it's always the same thing. It may not be the truth, but it is how I remember it.
That's right.
And that's how it will go down.
And who does it hurt? And if it puts you in a positive emotional state and you can learn from it, maybe replicate, make the future better, winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Right. If you haven't figured out yet, throughout the podcast here, you're going to hear some great one-liners from Mr. Sadoff, because you can't be around him for more than 15 minutes without hearing a winner, winner, chicken dinner. If life gives you lemons, I'm not going to take them all away, but they're pretty awesome ones. So you get out of the military, and then you go to school at?
Madison. Well, I went to UW Fond du Lac first semester. It was awesome. Got out, so that was the second semester of 93. Glad I stayed in Fond du Lac. That's where I met my wife at an establishment on 23. It wasn't a library, but there's a lot of talking and conversation.
It was the library.
Yes. Yeah. And then I went to Madison. And going back to the story about my dad and how he couldn't make money doing old cars and restoring them, so he found a way to be around it. I always wanted to play Division I football. And I had a friend, Corey Raymer, who was on the Badgers. What held me back from playing Division I football, and it wasn't, I didn't want to do Division III or NAI or anything. I wanted Division I. My height, my quickness, my strength, and my agility are what held me back.
Yeah, but mentally, your looks, I mean, if it would have been looks, you would have gotten
mentally, I was there. A lot of six-foot people. You know, I'm 6'2", 240. Football, that sounds awesome. I'm glad you can't see me. You only can hear me. You can picture what I look like. But
husky, isn't that husky, how you always describe
yourself? Yes, yeah. My mom never said I was heavy. She says, we're going to get you those husky granules. Thanks, so what happened is I wanted to play Division I football. I went to Madison. And I figured, you know, if I can't play, I'll be around it. So I was an equipment manager for the Badgers. So my 4 years there, I worked with Wisconsin, and I would be a ball boy. But I was in charge of, I was a head equipment manager and set up the locker rooms. I went on the road, rode the semi, flew on a plane. I got to go to Hawaii, to Stanford, to all the different bowl games. I missed the Rose Bowl because my sister and brother-in-law got married on that day. So I told them the marriage better work because I had to miss the first World's Bowl '94 because of that. But it was, I learned a lot of stuff there too. My daughter now goes to Madison. Unfortunately, she's working with the Badgers, and she's starting to realize that too, is that college and experiences aren't always just what you learn in the class, but it's those relationships, and it's the opportunities where you can really apply yourself and see what really goes on in the world and how you could fit. So, yeah, I went to Madison, and then I got into teaching, and my romantic story of why I got into teaching is I told people I'd get into teaching, and when I started down the road, I'm like, why change my major? It just costs more, so I kept doing it. And I love history, so I have a secondary education and history, Broadfield Social Studies. Graduated in 97. Actually got married as a sophomore to my wife, Kelly, while we were in college. She's a dental hygienist. She was going to MATC. I was going to UW-Madison. And so graduated, got my first job at Manitowoc Lincoln High School. Jim McCarty was a principal there. I was history, but I was licensed for psychology, and I was going to go to the middle school to teach history. And then Mr. McCarty said, hey, Aaron, it looks like you know what you're doing. You look like you're a pretty decent teacher. You're licensed for psychology. What do you think? We have the opening up at Fond du Lac, or at Manitowoc Link for psychology. I'll support you, but you seem like a good teacher. You can figure out that content, can't you? And I'm like, sure, you bet. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started teaching psychology, and that's what I taught all the way through my teaching career up until 2005. Side note with Jim McCartney, if anybody sees him now, I haven't seen him in a couple of years. He's ponytail, I think. You know, I think he's going through his fourth childhood. I'm not sure, but he's one of my biggest mentors. And one moment he told me, and this has stayed with me and helped me out a lot, is my second year teaching. I lived in Sheboygan, commuted up to Manitowoc, and I got a job offer at Sheboygan North, or the middle school that feeds into North. I went into his office and I said, "Hey, Mr. McCartney, you know, we got all these great things going and at Manitowoc, and I'm doing all this." And I was a great teacher. And if you wouldn't believe it, you could have just asked me because I could have
right,
told
right.
you.
6%? What did you say before?
Yeah. So I was just really good at it. And he looked at me and he said, "Aaron, you're not that important." And it threw me back. And I'm thinking in my mind, what? And he goes, "I'm not either. This place has been here long before you and I got here. It'll be here long after. You owe nothing. You work hard every day and you do the best to make this place great. When you leave, it should be better than when you got here, and you better set somebody else to be successful." Because mm-hmm. that's how great people are, is the people that come after them are more successful. He says, "You do whatever you got to do for your family. If you're here for a year, here for 20 years, get over yourself."
Yeah, I had a very similar experience with a principal who had said, we were driving and he pointed to a cemetery. He said, "That place is filled with people who thought the world couldn't live without him."
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like 26. I was like, what does that mean? And every time I drive past the cemetery, I think, oh, well, he's right. Things will move on. We'll go from there.
It's a freeing thing, too. I mean, I tell when I have staff coming in, they have different opportunities. I always say, you got to go for it. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel more empowered when I realize that I'm not that big of a deal, that I can really do things. I mean, it's an empowering
thing. But that's leadership, right? That's positioning the people who you serve to do what's best for them and their family. Amen. Not what's best for me in the moment, or not what's best for others. And I think many of the people that we work around and are around, and I think a lot of leaders are like, no, I need you. You can't leave me. And there's a key word in there that gets stuck. That's me. Mm-hmm. This isn't about me. It's about you, about your family, your future. And I think some people are taken aback by that when you have that interaction where they're like, hey, I'm thinking of leaving. and you say to them, well, geez, how great, what a great life opportunity for you.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, don't you like me?
Love you.
Yeah. No, it has nothing to do with whether I like you or not. It's what's best for you. And if you, if, you know, if you're not happy here, I need you to be happy somewhere.
Yeah. And if we somehow impacted you that you think you can help a culture or help things better, now take Oriole Nation. That's the school district North Fond du Lac. Our mascot's Oriole. Take it with you. Make those other places better. You know, that brings up really quick, public education, private education, whatever. I always think to myself, my daughter, I have two daughters and a son. I really don't know if they're going to marry somebody that has been through the school district North Fond du Lac. All the police, all the people who serve me food, all the people who are getting the doctors, the nurses, everybody takes care of me. I'm highly doubtful every one of those people will go through the school district of North Fond du Lac. And it slays me and then invigorates me why we're in competition to be better than the other one. Where why shouldn't we be in competition together so that we can all make everybody better? So that's, you know, when we were talking about, you know, you want what's best for everybody else. I look at our great state of Wisconsin or the United States. Why wouldn't we want what's best for people regardless? You know, my success is not based on your failure. And if my success can help you be more successful, cool. Mm-hmm. And your success will definitely help me be more successful.
Yeah, and that brings us to a point. I'm just going to pause kind of in your life journey there. That one of the things that Aaron and I have had the great opportunity to be in is we've been in some unique environments together. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been with the governor. We've been in front of the assembly, the Senate. We've argued with elected officials. Not like argued, but like, trying to move mindsets. But one of the pieces, again, with Aaron that I try to model often is we'll be in an environment with, 60, 70 people, and the tide will start to turn towards pessimism and negativity. And I think both of us do a good job of just kind of sitting back there. But Aaron's got a gift for the moment, which is I'm going to be the last one to speak here to turn this back around. We're not going to drive south the whole day. And that's where you're very Buffalo in your nature of, you know what, that's it. Let's go headlong into this and let's think this through. I mean, although we may not like the perspective of this elected official we're speaking with, think about where he's coming from or where she's coming from. And that's a real, real gift for you. So
I appreciate that.
So you leave Manitowoc, you end up going to Fond du Lac High School, teaching in Fond du Lac mm-hmm. High School, getting your administrative degree. Well, tell us about graduate school. Where did you go to grad school?
Marion. And I did that when I was in Manitowoc, and it was great. It was people. Once again, I had some really great professors. I learned a lot of things, but it was the people. And I really enjoyed. I got that degree early. My goal, if I had one job that I really wanted, it was assistant principal. I thought I could be really great at it. I never got the opportunity. I probably won't. Maybe I will. Maybe somebody would hire me as an assistant principal. You can aspire to other things. Yeah. But yeah, I love that. I mean, so I went to Marion University. I got my degree, and then, you know, I applied, and nothing really came to fruition until I got this opportunity to go to Bessie Allen Middle School in North Fond du Lac. And the great thing there, so Jim Sievert, he was, I actually graduated a year before him. He and I were friends in high school. He got hired as a superintendent in North Fond du Lac in 06, and I got hired as a middle school principal in 06. And when we got in there, you know, things are changing and evolving, but he allowed me to be part of negotiations. I was the IT director. I got to do it. He gave me the opportunity to do things. And I really, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be where I am right now. So then after 3 years, I started to learn more about this whole board and school district thing. And that's when he went to Fond du Lac, and I had no desire to be a superintendent. I didn't have any classes at all. But I figured, you know, this is a job I can do. It's about relationships. It's about, you know, being there for people. It's about creating an environment. It's about, you know, letting people, you know, serving people. So I applied, I got the job, and then I went back to Marion, got my degree in superintendency. I'm not a doctor, and I don't think that's
going to be... But you did stay at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so...
And that won't be in the cards, I think, you know, your lifestyle. But I tell you, all of my friends that are superintendents that go through that program, I mean, just going through that and getting that degree, I have a lot of admiration for people that get their doctorate and go through that process. But, you know, so I become superintendent, and that's when I think this is my favorite job I've ever had. And I think Jim Sievert said it so well. When you go from teaching to being an administrator, you change careers. When you go from being an administrator to a superintendent, you now have a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lifestyle. And it's the best ever. You know, if I'm at the grocery store and I'm checking out, sometimes, you know, like people will be like, oh, where do you get your beer and stuff like that? Well, I'll get my six-pack of beer. And if somebody says, hey, Mr. Sudoff, party at your house? You know what? When you're 21, we'll have this conversation. But you know what? We always have a lot of fun at my house. I hope you have fun at yours, too.
Yeah.
So it's fun, but you're always on. You're always representing public education, and it's been great. And I think this through Act 10, which is in the rear view mirrors, and what I think our colleagues in all over in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin education is incredible. And I think we're taking a lot of what we're doing here and sharing and helping the rest of the country too, and taking great things from the rest of the country and helping us out. But my journey got me to be superintendent of North Fond du Lac, and I couldn't imagine being here. And now I think about it, I couldn't imagine not being able to help support people and be there to help them have a better life.
So I want to transition then to kind of where you evolved into, the professional optimist. So one of the things I've always admired about you that I never had the opportunity to do in leadership ever was, as a superintendent, Aaron is, his office is in the school, and the school is the school. And what's really neat about it is, as the superintendent, he's got strong staff relationships. The principals know him, obviously. The kids know him. And he brought to North Fond du Lac a level of optimism that he actually created a process and picked up on a process, got trained in, and now goes all over the country, literally, and inspires others through, your orange frog philosophy that you brought back to North Fond du Lac. And one of the unique things when you go to North Fond du Lac is there's a cultural speak that you can't replicate anywhere else, where the teachers can talk about why they need to be optimistic, not just why they have to be optimistic, but they act optimistic. They are optimistic. And he's got a risk-charged environment. So walk us through that journey, and then we're going to end here the last 5-10 minutes talking about what are those core principles of Orange Frog that you do bring out. So talk to us about the journey to getting North Fond du Lac and the staff and the community to where they are. The orange frog lines up with your school colors. I mean, it just happens to be guys got orange shoes, orange glasses, orange shirts. Yeah. So tell us, how is that journey?
Well, I think my journey is not that unique per se, because there's always been people who've been optimistic, who have seen what the power of positivity can do. When you think of what you do matters and how that can impact, you know about resiliency, you know about hard work. I think just to really understand where we're at right now, psychology used to always be about negative behaviors and how we can get everybody back to normal. It was always about disabilities, how we can get there. In the mid-90s, a guy by the name of Martin Seligman, who was the one who did a whole bunch of research on learned helplessness, started to look at resiliency. And we saw the birth of positive psychology. Abraham Maslow did a little bit, but it wasn't really scientifically based. And from Seligman's work, and now it's just exploded about the power of happiness and how businesses are using this idea of happiness and how it can help you with the bottom line. A gentleman by the name of Sean Aker in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, wrote a book called The Happiness Advantage. And The Happiness Advantage, it's great. It talks about 5 key things you can do in order to be happier, be in a positive emotional state, defines what that is, and then how you can then put that into companies and into work. There's things called post-traumatic growth. It's like we've always heard about post-traumatic stress, but you think about somebody who's got cancer. I can think about one of the people I work with, Bonnie. She's just an amazing lady. Cancer didn't bring her down, it made her better. How many times do we see people go through adversity and come out on the positive side? So what Sean Aker did then is he wrote this book, but we also found out that normally, these textbooks don't really relate much these professional books don't relate well, and they kind of fizzle off. Well, a group at International Thought Leaders Network developed Orange Frog. With Sean Aker, they wrote this 60-page book, a parable about frogs. Mm-hmm. They have the thrall, they're all green when they're unhappy, and then when they do these things, it makes them orange so they're happy. And it's about how do we embrace a culture where we look at the good that goes on instead of trying to pull it down, how we change our social scripts so that, one of the biggest things that in North Fond du Lac that we do, and I challenge anybody out there, celebrate the good. Mm-hmm. We have such a hard time celebrating the good in this country because we think people don't want to hear it or they're bragging. News doesn't talk about it, but there's so much more good than bad going on. And one of the key components in what research is showing is talk about that. So I heard about that. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is it? And now I got research to back up what I believe in. So I had my board. They were kind enough to write my contract. I went out, got trained in Orange Frog, and brought it back. And it's just been amazing. Our school district has grown over 200 kids in the last 3 years. I mean, we're about 1,440 kids right now. Our open enrollment from 10 years ago was negative 40 net out. Now we're plus 90 and we're shutting down. We just passed a $29.5 million referendum at a 70% approval. And the reason we're doing that and retaining staff, our achievement scores are not where they need to be. I mean, that's something we can actually get better at. But the reason we have that success is, number one, the people we have in our district. Number two, the culture we have. And our culture is not reliant on a person. It's reliant on people. And that's something we're still working through, where whoever comes in, yeah, we want to learn from you, but you don't mess with this, because we're all about making a difference. The third part is our opportunities. So I have really seen what culture can do. You know, you always measure, we see report cards, we see, you know, ACT tests, we see all that. Our kids will get there. We have a lot of different variables where they're at, but what makes it work is the culture you're in. And that's huge, because if I ask anybody, what do you want for your child, or what do you want out of a life? Hardly anybody will say, well, I want them to be fully engaged and have an opportunity to be able to go here and here and here. What do you want for your kids? For your three kids? Do you have two, right?
Mm-hmm.
For your two kids, for my three kids, I want them to be happy.
Well, and that's, you know, when we would survey parents when I was a middle school principal, what are your expectations for your child this year? I want them to enjoy coming to school. I want them to have friends. And I want them to participate and take risks. To your point, no one ever says, I want my child to be advanced in English. I want them, I mean, they do.
Right, and that's but important.
It's
not,
but it's like 7, 8, 9, and 10. 1, 2, 3 are those. I mean, when my son Charlie was born, to your point, and we had a son, it made my wife nervous a little bit. Like, you know, I know how to navigate girls, but I don't really know how to navigate boys. And she'd been around enough, you know, she's got brothers, I've got brothers. Every night she whispered into my son's ear, I just want you to grow up and be kind. And I would always say, like, hey, whisper a little, like, algebraic skills in there, you know? And she'd be like, come on, no, what do we want him to be?
Yeah.
And his whole life. And I'm blessed. That's who he is.
And he's works, very kind. Doesn't it?
Yeah. So with that, Aaron, tell us a little bit about, like, how do you deal with the cynics? So one of the things, you know, like people like yourself, or I'd like to include myself in that kind of over-the-top obnoxious optimist, you will run into people who'll be like, you know, all they're doing is that happiness stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and they're not focusing on the right things. Mm-hmm. You know, so what do you say to that? I mean, how do we buffalo through that?
Well, I think a couple things. First off, happiness people see as something else, or as, oh, this is, we're rebranding engagement or relationships or something. Happiness to me is a technology. It's what makes everything else more efficient and effective. When you're in a positive emotional state, you can learn about higher level things. You can make better relationships. Bottom line is, you've never made good decisions when you're angry. I know I haven't, and the proof is out there.
Best decision you can make when you're angry is not to make a decision.
One. Nice. That's right. Found that one.
Yeah, pounded it.
All right.
Yeah.
I would say you're always going to have, I heard this word, caves, citizens against virtually everything. You're always going to have people out there, and that's okay. You know, it's like, it's all right, brother. If you want to be miserable, that's cool. I care about you, and you know what? You're going to see the success here. And when you're ready, we're going to be there for you. You know, it's okay. It's not, you don't have to convince everybody. Our success is not based on everybody believing in this. There's a saying, and this is something I learned from Sean Aker and from doing this Orange Frog training. You used to hear fake it till you make it, right? We have a different theory. Do it till you believe it. So you're telling me that if I do 3 gratitudes every morning, write them down, after 21 days, I'm going to be better off. Really?
Yeah,
give it a run. So you're telling me that if I consume less calories than what I burn, I'm going to lose weight. Really?
Right.
You know, so it's
right.
One of these things.
Tomatoes are healthy.
Really? You know, so, but if you do it over time, people start to see it. And it's not only them, but they start to see, wow, I want to be around kind people where what they think and what they do matters, and they treat me valuable.
Well, again, and I've talked about that on the podcast before, is that before you go to sleep, ask yourself 2 questions. What did I do well today? And what am I going to do better tomorrow? Most people lay in bed and reflect upon, in a 24-hour day, they think about like the 6 things that went wrong, and they let it, to your point, you know, they create a movie in their head that was my whole day.
Yeah.
And I've learned over time that I'm not giving anyone that power anymore. And I think that's a maturity factor that takes time to get to. But if we can get kids, like you have in North Fond du Lac, if you can get people to stop and think, I'm not giving you that. You don't get to take that away from me. I'm going to focus on my own happiness. And that's, you know, when you see Aaron present, you can probably feel the energy and hear it in the podcast. When you see Aaron present, you can't help but walk away almost feeling, and I don't mean this in a religious sense, but it's a ministry for you. Like, this is your calling. You are
a happiness evangelist.
A happiness evangelist. Because people like Aaron and I share this too, and because he and I've had this conversation over the years. Sometimes people like us are hard to take serious. It's like, do you really ever just stop like goofing around? Do you ever stop like seeing like the funny thing in the picture, or you know, somebody makes a weird gesture and we point it out? And it's like, well, I could sit here and focus on all the things wrong with all the world around me, to your point, the people who like to live in caves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, talk to us more about when you're out in the field, like nationally, like how do people respond to you when you show up? Because
so I was in Oklahoma, vulnerability. And you know what? I do have crummy days. And I think one of the things that held me back from really getting opportunities is I didn't let people, I wasn't vulnerable. I thought that would be weak. I don't like to dwell on complaining, but there are times where there's things that are hard. There's just life sucks and there's some difficult stuff and you got to work through it. But then you have the tools to help you get through it better. So I think being vulnerable and letting people know that, you know, there is some times where I'm struggling and you have to verbalize that to them. Mm-hmm. They can start to see that. And then that kind of chips away with that Pollyannish thing. I was in Oklahoma and I was fortunate enough to do a presentation at a conference down there that had administrators, business officers, principals, all that. And it was me and this gentleman, Devin. Devin Hughes, great guy. If you go on LinkedIn, he's got this, like, always a picture with the quote of the day. It's mm-hmm. awesome. So we're down there, we're doing this presentation on happiness at the Orange Frog. And we got on stage 15 minutes. This was like June 6th, 15 minutes after, and this is in Norman, Oklahoma, Bob Stoops announced his retirement.
Oh, I remember the story, yeah.
So we're in there. There's 1,000
Bob seats. Stoops was the football coach for the Oklahoma Sooners.
He was the longest tenured coach.
Legend.
Huge. So he retires. And so we're there, and there's this 1,000-seat area. Now there's 600. They're not by the stage. They're all milling about. And I'm telling you, it was like pulling teeth. Those people in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it'd be like seeing Lombardi leave Green Bay, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was – so when it's all said and done, so we're talking about, you know – that was just like, there's so many, and there's other things in Oklahoma. I really love people from Oklahoma. They work so hard. They got so much things they have, adversity that they've gone through. But afterwards, you know, I got some emails. Hey, thanks for this. I picked up on this. So it's one or two things. But during the time, it's like, don't forget the message. Like a lot of times, like Frank Luntz, that words matter. A lot of times people lose the ability to impact is when they forget about who they truly are and what they do. And they let other people or other things kind of throw them off that proven road that really helps them. Know your stump speech, whatever that is with your kids, your life, who you are, your elevator speech, you know, whatever that is. But stick to that. Be vulnerable, but realize that, like you had said, you have the power to impact you. And there's more research. Sean Akers coming out with a book. The power to impact oneself is huge, but when we work with other people and try to make them happy, our cap of being successful gets blown out. It's kind of like a Peloton. If you think about bike racing, if you're off on your own, it's tough. But once you're in a group, you're working like, I don't know, 10, 20% less, and you're going faster. And we're going to start seeing with research now, which I'm really jacked up about, is that it's not about me being happy. It's how can I inspire and help you be happy? Because when we have that together, the window or the ceiling of success gets blown up. So I think it's unwavering, knowing that being happy doesn't mean that you're always joyful and blissful. Being happy is about working hard towards something that you really like running or going towards a goal or anticipation and pride or hard work, embracing that. That's what happy is. Happy is so many things rolled into one. And it's just knowing it works.
You just sparked a reminder of an experience for me in college where we had a philosophy professor who started out the day and he wrote two words on the board. And he said, for the next half hour, you're going to get in small groups and you're going to debate and define the difference between these two words. And it was content and happy. And for the next half hour, here are all these undergrads, you know, like we're in, you know, varsity sweaters and talking about how smart we are, like a bunch of, you know, kind of 50s beatniks or something. It's all over and everybody makes their presentations. And he said, here's the answer. There is no difference. If you are content, you have reached a level of happiness. And if you are happy, you are working towards being content. And I remember thinking, like, I don't know, I remember thinking this, even then, this is over my pay scale. But to you, what you just said is, you know, if you're constantly working on it and you're content in who you are, and you're developing those core attributes of personal leadership, you can't be stopped by people around you. And that's, yesterday I was with a man who I consider a mentor of mine, Mike, and he just popped in on a work session we were in. He's like, hey, you know, and he just started rattling off all these things, but he said something in between there. He goes, You know, the idea that we can rehab people is a failed idea. All you can do is model what you expect, be who you are, and hope they come along on the journey. And it's exactly what you just said. Influence their happiness by being happy. Influence their outcomes by helping show them how to get to it. Opposed to going through the world trying to change everyone you meet, because you can't. That's a failed mission.
Yeah. There's no need to change anybody. I mean, that's you had just before we got on the podcast, you're talking about parents being farmers. I mean, all you can do is create an opportunity for people to go. And here's a killer part, too. I'm 46 years old and I'm starting to realize, I think it was Socrates or Plato that says, I realize I'm really smart because I realize I don't know much. I'm now starting to really understand that I can garner things from other people. Other people can't make me happier or better, but I can listen to them, hear what they're saying, and incorporate that into me. So, you know, that's something that's really hit me that says, Aaron, your mission is continually to do what you can, the best you can, because if you're learning from other people and you're doing these things and they're a way that can make the world better, maybe relationships stronger, or just make people feel that what they think and what they do matters, somebody's going to pick up on it. Because like I said earlier, I think maybe instead of just thinking about anybody that's a superintendent in your life, you have a lifestyle. When people start thinking about how I live, that's my lifestyle, and people see that, your kids, your friends. So it's a choice. That's the thing. Happiness is a choice. It's hard work, but it's so worth it because it's a technology that can make everything else better.
It just feels good.
It does.
I mean, it's just plain and simple.
Yeah. And you're happy. Like, for instance, Wim Hof. Have you ever heard of Wim Hof?
I just did.
Oh, gosh. Wimhof. Guy's outstanding. He's about meditation, cold exposure. He climbed Mount Everest in like no shirt or something like that. I don't know. It's unbelievable.
Eating pizza.
So I've been going outside the past 2 weeks since the New Year's. To my New Year's, I go outside like when it's like -10 with the dog, with just my pants and my Crocs, you know. And I'm doing this cold training, but this mindset. But he just hit it right on the nose about, you know, people say, should I breathe in through my nose or my mouth? He goes, who cares? Just try it.
Breathe.
Breathe. It's, you know, do your best. It's progress, not perfection. You know, we're already there. You know, and Sean Aker's biggest thing that resonated, that really has driven his work, is that whole idea of success leads to happiness. You know, it's reversed. It's reversed over and over. His research shows, and people in general, if I'm in a positive emotional state, if I'm happy, and I like saying positive emotional state because there's so many other things. People get cornered in on what happy is. Yeah. Success happens. It's going to happen. You're going to see it work.
Well, I think one of the pieces, too, that you've been able to demonstrate is there's a difference between happiness and joy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, joy is the moment. Happiness is a mindset, a lifestyle. You don't have to be smiling and laughing all the time. And one of the other core characteristics, Aaron, before we wrap up here that I want to talk about, too, is you have a really strong strength in empathy. Where does that come from?
All right. We've been lied to in our lives. I learned this from Mike Dresser, football coach. Well, actually, I didn't learn from him. He believes how everybody else does, but him and I have had this conversation, and I love the man. He's helped me through. He's a philosopher, too, football coach philosopher. We've always been told, I'll trust you until you prove me wrong, and you have to earn my respect. Okay? And I'm so tired of hearing people say, they don't respect me, they don't blah, blah, blah. Well, I define respect as treating someone or something as valuable. Okay? At what point in time, how you treat me should dictate that I don't treat you as valuable. You can do anything. I try to tell my kids, whoever will listen, respect is given. Nobody has to earn it from me. I will treat you valuable all the time, regardless of what you do, because you are. I respect you. You don't have to earn that. Trust, on the other hand, believing that they know the right thing to do and that they're going to do it, I don't trust my seventh grader. Do I know he knows the right thing to do? Yeah. Do I think he's going to do it? Heck no. So why put him in that situation? So earn trust, but give respect. So to your point, I think that's when you look at the whole idea of empathy is, you know, I try to treat people as valuable regardless. And then the second part I think I do is I judge them as good. You know, I think Todd Whitaker, a motivational speaker, I got some stuff from him that I've kind of really marinated on. You know, parents don't wake up in the morning and say, you know, I know how to be a great parent, but today I'm bringing my C game. My kids or that you work with or your colleagues, teachers, they don't come into work or school and say, you know, I know how to really knock this out of the park, but I'm going to suck. The reason they don't do well is probably because of something that we're not aware of. So by respecting people and treating them as valuable and then judging them as good, regardless if it's true or not, it helps how I work. That's really the mantra that's helped me in all situations to really deal with people, because even if they have a very different mindset than me, they're doing the best they can with what they have. So why would I think they're not?
Yeah, and who are we to judge that it's not good enough?
Right.
I think that's one of the neat parts about the culture of your staff and the people that you work with, though, too, is that in the education business, when you are a teacher in a classroom and you've got, you know, your 22 to 38 kids or whatever you have in that room at that moment, to your point, no one gets up and says, I'm going to do the least amount of work today that I possibly can. And the one piece I think we can all get better at is what you said, which is understanding that no one in that classroom, none of those students, no parent, no support person, no lunch lady, no maintenance guy, whatever, goes there thinking, yeah, I'm going to try to find the path of least resistance.
Or I can do it better.
Right.
Because even if they do find that path of least resistance, that's what they've learned. That's all they know.
Right. But if we go in with the mindset of wonder what happened today or where they're at or where they're at in this moment with a sense of I'm going to bring some happiness. I mean, you guys, those of you listening, you need to understand when you walk down the hallway with Mr. Sadoff, he's popping his head in and out of classrooms. He's high-fiving staff. And not for one moment does it feel disingenuous. You feel like you're walking down with the, you know, the assistant mayor of the community, the ambassador of happiness. And it's just how you are everywhere. So it always brings me great joy to hear that you are working in other systems across the country to help those people. And that's something that anyone who's listening, you can find you at what? What's your Twitter handle?
Aaron Sadoff. I'm more of a voyeur on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn, but I've got a website. Email's really good. asadoff@nfdlschools.org. I got a Facebook page, but you know, I did a TED Talk. Woo! You know, yeah. That's kind of exciting. So you can check that out. But
You're welcome for that. I just really appreciate my name and concept has taken off.
TEDx, because I did, you know.
Oshkosh, right? Or Fond du Lac?
Fond du Lac, yeah. That was a journey. But thank you for asking me to be part of this podcast. I really, this is fun. And there is no limit to success. And there's no, this isn't an exclusive thing that only Aaron Sadoff or Ted Nyskie can have. This is available and it's free. It's like Linux, man. It's out there. Grab it, make it better. You know, it's Wikipedia. You can do it. Make it happen.
What's one way that anyone listening can walk away from this? And what, not one way, what's one thing they can do different today to just be a better person?
Okay. Steve Jones, head coach of Kimberly High School. Great guy. They've won, I think, 6 straight or 5 straight championships, Division I, 70 straight games. Talk to him and his mindset for his team. And it's really not about winning for them. It's about a mindset and a culture. I mean, they got like 38 seniors and only like 10 play, but they all want to be part of this thing. One of the things he really talks about is this idea of get to. I get to go to practice. I get to work today and do another line. I get to work out. I get to do these things instead of I have to. You know, my brother-in-law, Matt, who was diagnosed with cancer and he had like a 5% chance to make it to surgery so that they could help him. He had the mindset, I get to have chemotherapy because I can be around my family more. I get to have radiation. I get to go to this family function because I wouldn't see them very, you know, that get to. Because if there's one thing I can say right now that if you can go and walk out, if you say, I get to go do this or I get to go do that or I get to work, I get to help somebody out or I get to have this difficult conversation to make things better. When you get to, you're grateful. And when you're grateful, you're in a positive emotional state. And when you're in a positive emotional state, everything else is easier. So if I'd say one thing that you can do right now is just think of things as you get to. Funny side note. So my wife came and I had talked about this in my TED Talk. It's Monday morning. We're outside having some coffee. She works in a medical field. And she looks at me. She goes, hey, Aaron. I know you're off today, but I get to go to work.
But That is the dangerous part about being like us is that people will throw that right back in our face.
And it's awesome. Yeah. You smile and then we had a funny there. But get to, when you're grateful, you're in a better emotional state. The more gratitudes and the gratefulness you can show, the better you're off and you're going to deal with people better and you're going to be happier and you're going to be more well-adjusted and you're just going to make a better impact.
And I'll tell you, people like Aaron and I do exist. And that's one of the pieces where we've talked about this as well. Our spouses, when they get around people when our spouses get around people who know you and I or you, and they don't know your spouse, what's one of the first things they ask your spouse?
Is this really how they are?
Yeah. Are they always like this? Yeah. And it's one of those pieces where like, yeah, they actually are. And it is, my wife will say it's like positively exhausting.
Yeah.
because he won't let me be in a bad mood, or he won't let the kids have a bad day, because he'll, what can we, you know, how can we make today better? Now, at the Nightski House, we'll probably talk about what we get to do.
Yeah, and I would say final thing that I got is Margaret Thatcher, the Iron Lady, back the Cold War. She had a quote that I just love, and it was, being in power is like being a lady. If you have to tell someone you are, you're not. And I think that's with living a life of happiness and joy and gratitude. Don't tell anybody what you're doing. Just do it. They'll figure it out.
And because you didn't say it, I have to ask you, what do you have to say about when life gives you lemons?
Fine, clear liquid, man, whatever that is for you. I know what my choice is. Make it better. Don't accept what they give you.
Aaron Sadoff, everybody. Thank you, Aaron, very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ted. Thank you. We're shaking hands, and it's very formal.
Yeah. We're going to get a photo taken.
Take care.
Thank you.